Well, thanks. Great to be back at the KATP. I was asked to talk today a bit about single cell genomics, which is kind of the flavor of the month right now, and it's getting a lot of attention and press, and you know, a little overheated actually. And so I like to start out the talk always by reminding people that it's a very old field. And in fact, dates back to the 19th century when Walter Fleming noticed that in some insect cells, there were just gigantic chromosomes you could see with your eyes under a microscope, which are known as polyteen chromosomes. And it's, you know, an effect due to polyploidy in certain cells, and Drosophila, it happens in the salivary glands. And it's not unique to Drosophila, other insects have it. And it was more than just a curiosity, actually. And it was put to practical use by Calvin Bridges at Caltech in the 30s, where he used that phenomenon to map the genome at low resolution. That sort of mapping approach was used for decades in the Drosophila community to track differences between lines and individuals and species and so forth. And so, in fact, there is a very long and glorious history to this idea of single-cell genomics. But it has taken off with a vengeance recently, thanks to, I think, the confluence of three different technological advances. Those are, first, the development of biochemical amplifiers, such as PCR and MDA. And PCR itself was developed back in the 1980s. And almost from the very first paper, people realized that this high-gain amplifier should be useful for looking at gene expression and gene sequence in single cells. And there's a literature that dates back to that time. But again, it never really took off, remained sort of a niche area because the other two pieces were missing. One of which is the development of high-throughput sequencing technologies, which have really revolutionized the kind of ways we can interrogate organisms, both at the level of transcriptome and genome. And the third is the development of single-cell manipulation technologies, such as fluorescent-activated cell sorting, microfluidics, other tools that lets you do single-cell measurements in large enough numbers to get interesting statistics. And with all three of these together, it's a very potent combination, and the literature has been exploding in the last few years with all kinds of interesting results. Nature Methods called the Method of the Year in 2013, and if you go to the January 2014 issue, that's the one where it's discussed. And several of us wrote sort of opinion pieces about where we think the field is going. And that's a reasonable entree to the field, I think, to refer to that. My own sort of involvement in the field came through several routes. Probably the most direct was the work we had done trying to develop ways to automate biology by inventing the sort of equivalent of the integrated circuit for biology, which involved making little chips with lots of micromechanical valves. Now tens to hundreds of thousands of valves can be made on each chip. And we've been able to use those as manipulation tools in this area. And this, in fact, the work we did was the founding technology for Fluidigm Corporation. And sort of interest of full disclosure, I'm a founder and consultant for the company, and many of the things they've commercialized in single cell genomics are based on inventions from my lab. With that out of the way, I think the structure of the talk, we'll see how far we get. Feel free to interrupt at any time. I'm going to talk about single cell transcriptome analysis in the first part of the talk, and beginning with, you know, sort of emphasis on some of the measurement details and ways to quantitate and how quantitative you can be in this area. And in the second half, we'll talk a bit about how to do genome analysis in single cells. And there's a number of things we can get to. We'll see how far it goes. So Jian Liu, who was a student in the lab some years ago, developed this chip to do combinatoric measurements. And the idea was to make a matrix, a bunch of rows and columns, and it lets you do every possible combination of experiments of two sets of inputs. When you do it in the context of PCR, you can have a bunch of different samples in the rows and a bunch of different primer sets in the columns, and it provides a very nice sort of economy of scale. Our first chip was 20 by 20, which meant he could do 400 experiments with only 40 pipetting steps. When Fluidigm commercialized this, they made a 48 by 48, which lets you do more than 2,000 experiments with just 96 steps. And today, you can do almost 10,000 experiments with less than 200 pipetting steps. And in the context of single cell measurements, you put the lysates or some amplified form of the lysates in the rows, primer sets in the columns. That lets you interrogate lots of genes and lots of single cells. And when Tomer Kaliski joined the lab, he began trying to make all this work on single cells using Fluidigm's commercial version. And he did a bunch of sort of warm-up experiments with the cell line where he would do sort of lots of replicates. So each gene was done in triplicate, and each lysate was divided into three replicates. So you're getting nine-fold replicates for each experiment, for each measurement you wanted to do. And I should say that one of the important steps in this is to do a PCR preamplification. So the cells are, in this case, sorted by FACS into wells. They're lysed immediately into microliter scale volumes. The primer sets are there, and one does a sort of a small number of PCR cycles to do so-called preamplification, which provides a fairly linear amplification of the material and gives you enough reagents that they can be, enough copies of each molecule, they can be successfully dispersed across all the little chambers and still get reliable measurements. That's been shown to be a pretty benign step that doesn't introduce much distortion. Now, this is a picture of what you get out of the chip where it's color-coded by CT here. And so this is sort of amount of material that was there is the way to interpret it, or the log of that. And you can see that everything is coming out in these 3x3 blocks, which is what you'd expect for replicate measurements. And if you pick these three different cells and this particular gene and look at the actual amplification curves, so this is what happens during PCR. This is, you know, the number of cycles here, and this is the amount of fluorescence that's being made. And so you can see the fluorescence is growing exponentially. It's a log scale, that's a line, that's the way PCR works. It's an exponential amplifier. Then things start to saturate because you're running out of the constituent parts of the reaction. But you establish sort of an arbitrary threshold, and that's where the measurement comes from. But you can see here that for these 27 measurements, they're in groups of three, and this turns out to be each of the three different cells, and you can see the technical replicates are all grouping very close together, which starts to argue that the technical noise in the measurement is much less than the sort of stochastic biological noise from cell to cell. And we spent a lot of time worrying about that problem and trying to convince ourselves that our measurement noise was indeed less than the biological variation from cell to cell in cells that are very boring and genes that are boring. So cell lines where they're nominally all clonal and genes that are housekeeping genes, you don't expect a lot of biological variation. And you know, for many of the things we'd look at, we would, so these are titration curves with just bulk RNA, and you can titrate down to the level where you're doing single cell measurements. This is a histogram of the single cell results, and you can see that the width of the distribution here is broader than the CV of the equivalent measurement of just diluted bulk RNA. And we can march through this for all the genes. Here's another way to look at it. Different set of experiments here. So the previous were a cell line called HCT116, colon cancer cell line. These are neural stem cell line we did with Bakhtijan at Hughes. And Tomer, what he did here, some of these have been differentiated, so they're color-coded in this way. Each point is a different gene. And you can see that this axis is the average expression level in log units. This is the standard deviation. And the pluses are the measurements done on bulk RNA of similar amounts. So you can see for a given amount of RNA, this is kind of the noise you get from technical measurement, and this is the amount you get from biological variation. And pretty much the biological variation is always greater than the technical noise. Yeah. Okay. And so that puts you in a question to sort of ask questions about noise and gene expression. And you know, these questions have been very intensely investigated in bacteria over the past decade. And you know, some of the people thinking about Mike Elowitz, Ito Goling, Sunny Shi, and many others. There's been a smaller literature about eukaryotic gene expression noise, Hasty, Collins, Van Uden, and so forth. So we wanted to kind of flesh that out and learn a bit more about what's going on. Other things to have in your mind as we go through this was this curious paper by Sunny Shi where he looked in bacteria and found that RNA and protein levels for the same gene were completely uncorrelated at the single cell level. And that's a bit of a head-scratching thing, and how general is that phenomenon? And it really makes you worry that maybe you shouldn't be using RNA as a proxy for protein levels if there's no correlation. Generally speaking, those distributions that I flashed up, and we'll get into this a little more, are very broad. And in fact, everyone who's done single cell measurements in eukaryotic cells finds these very broad, almost log normal distributions. In some of the early literature, people sort of operationally said this looks like a log normal and the fit's pretty good. And so whether or not that's right, that's the correct function is something we'll revisit in a minute. But why are these distributions so broad? And I just, and we spent a lot of time thinking about measurement noise, it's not due to measurement noise. And finally, what happens when you look at more than one gene, and what's kind of the structure of correlation of noise between different genes? And we have an opportunity to look at that here by virtue of the fact that we're looking at lots of genes in each single cell. So what's the simple model to have in your head for gene expression? And this is kind of the physics model here, which says that, it's all just fluctuations off of sort of simple kinetic models. And the simplest one would be to ignore this bottom part and just say DNA makes RNA. RNA is either degraded or it makes protein with some rate. Protein gets degraded. Turns out that really doesn't capture qualitatively what's going on. And when you add this other little bit where you allow the DNA to fluctuate between an active and an inactive state, you start to get more reasonable results that start to connect to experiments. And many people have written this down and solved different limits of it in different forms. It's not something that's original to us. But you can think about this sort of active to inactive as, chromatin opening and closing, or transcription factor binding falling off, that sort of thing. So with a model like this, you can write down a master equation, you can compute all the moments, and you can compute some approximate distributions. And in some approximations, this sort of gamma function comes out, and in a further limit, you get log normal, okay? And so this is sort of what you expect from a model like this in terms of just transcript distribution. And so you can ask, are these approximations valid? Which one is more important? Is it which limit better captures what's going on in real cells? So we decided to look at that. And again, with these colon cancer cell lines and this sort of large set of measurements we did, we began fitting the distributions both to log normal and gamma functions and asked, how good is the fit for these? And that's what this shows up here. These are the genes on this axis. These are the p-values. If the p-value gets to be something non-trivial, it says, well, maybe it's not the right function. And you can see that, by and large, these are reasonable approximations. And, in some cases, the gamma function's a little better, but it's not a bad sort of mental picture to have. And here are some of the actual measurements, almost all of which are made with the mRNA level. In a few cases, we measure protein levels. In one case, because we had expressed GFP in the cell line, and others, we use surface markers and fluorescent antibodies. And you can see these are ones that were very well fit by both log normal and gamma functions. These are ones that were noticeably better fit by the gamma functions. And you can see the difference is there's a bit of skew to the distribution. Okay, they're not quite symmetric. And it's not a huge effect, but you see it come out in the p-values. So it would be very disappointing if this, if all the data agreed with the model, because the model is simply one of fluctuations, right? It has no role for the sort of deterministic role of gene expression programs and things like that. And you'd expect that additional level of complexity would break the model. This only talks about noise around steady state. And sure enough, some genes didn't fit the model, and neither of those functions fit well at all. And here are some examples of those. You can see the distributions are getting even broader and looking bimodal in many cases. And so what Tomer did here was pick one of the genes, top 2A, and draw a line down the middle. So half the cells were on one side, half were on the other. And he arbitrarily colored those cells as red or black. And then he asked, what do other genes look like? And so we look at all the red cells and look at the expression level of ANLN, for example, and all the black ones. And you can see that all the cells that had sort of low expression for TOP2A also have low expression for ANLN and vice versa for high expression. And similarly for BRK5. And so you can see there's these correlations here in these genes that are having these non-trivial distributions. Not all genes break out that way, BMPR1, GFP, no difference in the populations. What you might notice is these are all genes involved in the cell division process, right? So some of these cells are dividing and there's sort of a set of different states. Yeah, this is CT, okay? So it's like the log of the number of transcripts. Yeah, so you're kind of in a log coordinate here. And so if it's log normal, you'd expect a nice Gaussian distribution to the transcript levels.
And do you think these violations of the log normal, I mean, usually I guess people derive the log normal from first principles and everything, which is what you're referring to, but that's a steady state distribution, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's subpopulations with different states. Some are dividing, some are not, some of the cells. And you can look at sort of correlations across all the genes we measured, which is shown here. And so genes, and you can ask, are the genes whose expression levels are correlated? And all these involved in cell division ones I showed you right here. And so they're the sort of major ones there. And there's a few others poking around. And I'll come back to some of those other ones later. let's return to this question now of RNA-protein correlations. one of the moments you can compute from this model in a pretty straightforward way is the cross moment of RNA and protein level. So you can calculate expectation of RP. And it depends on two dimensionalist variables, one of which is the ratio of the two degradation rates of RNA and protein, which you can think about as the lifetime, so the RNA and the protein, okay? RNA lifetime and units of protein lifetime. And you can see that this RNA-protein correlation goes from 0 up to 1, depending on the sort of what those values happen to be. that sort of makes sense. If the RNA lifetime is very short compared to the protein lifetime, you wouldn't expect to see a correlation. That's, in fact, sort of generically the case in bacteria, and that basically explains Sunny's result. You wouldn't expect it to have a strong correlation instantaneously. In eukaryotes and mammalian cells, it can much longer RNA lifetimes in some cases, and so you can expect to see non-trivial correlations. And for various choices of parameters, this is what pops out in simulations. In the actual data, we were able to measure in a few cases. I mentioned we had cloned in GFP, and you can see here, each of these is a different cell. This axis is the fluorescence level of the protein, the amount of protein. This is amount of RNA. measured by PCR, and you can see there's a correlation. And if you start to correlate protein level, not just to the GFP RNA, but to all the other transcripts we measured, you get a distribution of correlation coefficients like this. This outlier here is the one that corresponds to the gene. That's the mRNA from GFP. These are all the rest. Likewise, with CD49, which is one of the surface markers we looked at, there's a correlation. And again, the highest correlated transcript is the one that codes for the gene. So that all makes sense, and you can, sort of rest easy in this notion that it's not a terrible approximation to use RNA as a proxy for protein levels in mammalian cells. Yeah, so that was in bacteria, okay? And so you're at a different part of this scale. So short RNA lifetimes in bacteria mean that it's generally uncorrelated. Longer RNA lifetimes in the mammalian cells means it generally a safe correlation. Yeah?
What is the distribution of how good that assumption is? Right? Like, so basically each gene you can actually track how good the correlation is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's complicated, right? And so there's a distribution, I don't have the figure, but it's something you want to keep in the back of your mind, let's put it that way. Yeah. But you're not off base by taking as a first order assumption that's going to be okay. Okay, let me talk about one more consequence of the fact that they distribute. Oh, let me talk about log normal for a minute. You mentioned first principles a minute ago, and there's sort of a standard argument by which people derive log normal distributions. It's sort of one step away from the central limit theorem. Central limit theorem says when you add random variables of arbitrary distribution, you get a normal distribution. Turns out if you multiply random variables, you get a log normal distribution for the same reason. You can take the log of the product, apply the central limit theorem. So in any case where you're multiplying random variables, on very broad assumptions about their distributions, you'll generically get log normal distributions. And what's happening in the cell? Well, there's a bunch of rate constants that are getting multiplied together to make your transcripts, and they're all fluctuating randomly. And so you're essentially multiplying random variables together. It's not surprising that you see broad distributions of transcript levels. And that log normal is a reasonable approximation. That's sort of the mental picture. It's one of the takeaway messages, I think, is what you should have about these processes. The details of the model are almost irrelevant. You end up multiplying a bunch of rate constants together. You should expect to see broad distributions. Now, another interesting consequence of log normal distributions is that when you take them back into the linear space, linear coordinate, they tend to be skewed, asymmetric, and the mode, the median, and the mean tend not to be the same thing. And so in log space, it looks Gaussian, it's perfectly symmetric, as your intuition about Gaussian distributions works, but in linear space, not the case. So if you think about what happens when you try to estimate the typical RNA level in a cell by bulk measurements, what do you generally do if you're not doing single cell measurements? You get a test tube with 1 million cells in it or 100,000 cells. You count the number of cells by some means. You lyse them, you measure the transcript level, you divide by the number of cells. Okay, that's taking the mean in linear space. Okay, and it is maybe not the most natural way to think about typical expression level of a cell, okay? I would argue you want to think about the central value in log space, okay, which ends up being the median, all right? And the median and the mean are not the same. They can differ by a certain amount. And so, if you thought about the median expression level of transcript level in a cell, then you could easily pop back and forth between linear and log space, but there's no way to measure the median level from a bulk measurement. You have to do a single cell measurement to get at that. And you can see that the mode and the mean are all displaced from the median by convolving with the width of the distribution, okay, which is sort of an unnatural thing to think about. So, there are a couple lessons from that. One is, if you really want to know the typical expression level, you should do a single cell measurement, and you can get the central value then from having the distribution. Second of all, if you're trying to estimate things from bulk measurements, how much of an error are you going to make by doing the bulk measurement, and how much is this changing things? We can estimate that now because we have measured all the distributions, and it turns out to be it depends on how much you care about the measurement, but typically, from 30 to 15% errors in gene expression level just from that systematic effect. Well, that's something to keep in mind. If you care about it at that level, you'll want to think about actually being able to measure the distribution. Okay. So we then, kind of went on in my group and with several collaborators and kind of marched through a bunch of biological problems using the single cell PCR, particularly in colon and colon cancer with Mike Clark's group, and use this as a tool to dissect heterogeneous tissues. Tumors are heterogeneous, even the within the colon there's numerous cell types, and we wanted to kind of work all that out, and which has historically been done by things like surface markers and flow cytometry, immunohistochemistry, and this single cell qPCR and RNA-seq, as I'm about to describe, become yet another way to kind of tease apart that complexity. I'll get into an example a little later, but for reasons of time, I'm going to leave the colon stuff aside. If you're interested, you can ask me about that later. We're going to talk about reverse engineering the lung, the developing lung, in a little bit. But to do that, we had transitioned from PCR to RNA-seq based measurements. So let me walk you through a few of the technical details of that. So we had been fiddling around with this in the lab, and several papers started to come out in the literature, and they're frankly not very quantitative. They're basically counting number of genes expressed, but not estimating gene expression levels. And so we thought it would be useful to ask this question of how quantitative can you be doing single cell RNA-seq? We and others have been playing around with two base techniques, so microliter volume amplifications of whole transcriptomes. Fluidigm had just come out with their C1 system, and so we thought it was a good opportunity to compare the small volume to the large volume, a few differences in the amplifiers, and to also compare PCR to RNA-seq, because we felt like we really understood all the technical errors in the PCR and knew how quantitative it was. Whereas the RNA-seq involved a much more complicated and uncontrolled amplification of the transcriptome. So we did that with our favorite cell line, these HCT116s, and this was done by Angela Wu. It's sort of reasonably reproducible. If you ask at the now sort of the very gross level, just how many genes do you see expressed in a reproducible manner between replicates? In the bulk experiments, it's in 90% range. In the single cell, no matter how you did it, it was sort of 50 to 60%. There's sort of a question about whether that's technical or biological or some combination of both. And we got to the point where we decided it was some combination, in part because of experiments like this, where we compared reproducibility against PCR-based measurements. So we look at a panel of 48 genes, and whether we measured them in the tube or the microfluidic volumes, the reproducibility was pretty high, 90%. When we go to the chips, the small volume transcriptome, and looked at those genes there, reproducibility was equally high. And then as you started going to these larger volumes, you see the performance start to drop off. So took this as evidence that it's better to go to smaller volumes. The amplifiers tend to work better. Everything's a little more controlled. The gain's a little lower, so you're not getting as much distortion. We then began to think about quantitation. One of the ways we got at that was to include spike-in molecules with each experiment. And so there are these NIST traceable controls called ERCC RNA standards, where you can get a test tube of RNA in which NIST has certified the number of molecules of each species that are in there. And so it's an absolute standard. And if you mix them in at a known concentration to the experiments, you can have an axis here where you've got spike-in molecules per reaction in units of molecules, known molecules. So you put them in, and in the RNA-seq, you get out an expression level for those species in these funny units called FPKM or RPKM, and you can compare the two and see that there's a pretty good connection. And it's reasonably quantitative. Now, these RPKMs or FPKMs are a very non-intuitive unit, right? It's a relative unit of reads per kilobase, exon per million reads sequenced. And how do you think about gene expression in those units? Well, you can do a sort of simple back of the envelope calculation. If you assume there's a couple hundred thousand transcripts in a cell, how do you interpret FPKM? And basically the answer is in molecules. One FPKM is roughly one molecule. And you can see that here. There's a log scale, so zero is one molecule, zero is one molecule. And they sort of, pretty well hit that there. And so if people are talking about single cell RNA-seq experiments and you have less than one FPKM, and they're trying to say that's significant, you've got to realize it's less than one molecule per cell, and you're going to worry about that if they're talking about a particular cell. You can see here, we're seeing expression at less than one FPKM, and that's because each point here is an average over 96 experiments. And so when you're at less than one molecule per experiment, a tenth of a molecule per experiment, well, 10 of the experiments will have a molecule, 90 don't, and you can average it out, and it sort of lets you extend your dynamic range, but only because you're looking at things in the average sense.
That's why you can't go beyond minus 2.
Yeah, correct. And the quantum efficiency here can also be estimated from this sort of thing. And sort of if you have a molecule, what's the chance you measure it? About 40%. If you have a single molecule in the experiment, the chance of seeing it is about 40%. you know, we can show that superposition basically works. So this is a rarefaction plot. This is how deeply you sequence into the sample. This is the number of genes you detect at a level of at least one molecule per cell. These are different single cell experiments here. And you know, there's some differences based on the chemistry. This is the small volume. And what happens is you take all your single cell experiments and merge them into one giant experiment in terms of merging all the reads together. And you ask, how does that compare to the bulk measurement? It's pretty similar. So you can sort of reproduce the bulk by just merging all your single cell measurements. And that seems to be a reasonable thing to do. The other thing I want to compare is two bulk experiments here. You can see that there's a significant difference in the number of genes detected. And the difference here is the particular chemistry that was used to make the transcripts and amplify them. And so there are, you know, there's a fair amount of effect from the molecular biology here on how you on what comes out the other end. And the, you know, the chemistry we like to use is actually a bit lower sensitivity, but it's designed to create full-length transcripts. And so you get the advantage of being able to pull out splice information, things like that. It's an experimental trade-off we sort of consciously decided to make. And then now, because we have studied the same cells, same cell line, in separate experiments, and measured gene expression both by PCR and RNA-seq, you can sort of estimate the accuracy of the measurement. So you're measuring the same thing by two completely different means. Do they agree? And more or less they do. These are the large volume, small volume is pretty similar. You can see that the slope of the line is 1. That's good. And you know, the correlation coefficient, the R's are all pretty good. We cheated a little bit because this is not an absolute unit. It's you know, we've normalized by the median expression, so there's a little bit of wiggle still in there. The ideal thing would be to have absolute units on both axes, right? One of the referees was upset with us and said that all the correlation is coming from those three outliers. Turns out if you delete those points, you get the same values through. So it's a similar correlation. Okay, so we became, you know, reasonably confident in using RNA-seq in a quantitative way. It's not as nice as qPCR in the sense that, you know, you're not limited only by the stochastic biological noise in every case. And some, in the sort of medium to low gene expression levels, the width of your distributions are dominated by technical noise. But if you average over many cells, you get something that's reasonably quantitative. Yeah.
Genomes that are genes that are being expressed at that time.
Yeah. Well, if you can estimate the number of transcripts per cell, then it connects pretty directly, right? And so, you know, it's probably a way to do that. And that's sort of how I'd recommend doing it. And then pursuing these rarefaction arguments. Once you start mixing things together, it gets a lot more complicated. That's a whole nother talk. So let me take you through at least one application of how we've used these in a complex tissue. This is work that was done by Barbara Troitlein in my lab. It was a postdoc at the time, and it was done in collaboration with Mark Krasnow's group at Stanford. And Mark's been interested in the developing lung. And you know, we decided to ask, you know, what's going on with the different cell types in the developing lung, and are there cell populations that have been missed by traditional approaches? And so, you know, there's sort of four cell types that were known. Two of them are alveolar cell types, and given the very creative names of alveolar type 1 and alveolar type 2, the type 1s are these big flat ones that create most of the surface area and where the gas exchange happens. Type 2 are these cuboid ones, and they feed the type 1s, you know, they secrete things to feed them. And, you know, There have been a very small number of genes that have been identified to be expressed in these cell types, and these, in fact, would define the cell types for most people. And then similarly in the bronchioles, there's two cell types, the Clara cells and the ciliated. And again, you know, there's secretory functions and ciliate things, and it and that was sort of it. And so what we did was to look at mice at embryonic day 14, 16, 18, as well as adults. They were sacrificed, the lungs were removed, the cells were dissociated. We did some light purification, either by MAX or FAX, depending on the experiment, to get rid of the immune cells. And then they were loaded into the microfluidic device. And then we did either whole transcriptome amplification or panels of genes to measure by qPCR. And so the readout was then either qPCR or RNA-seq. And you know, we'd use one to validate the other. So what do you see when you do this? Here is sort of an example of variation in gene expression from embryonic day 16 by RNA-seq. So every data point here is a different gene. And again, like I showed you in an earlier plot, this axis is the average gene expression of that gene. This axis is the, in this case, the standard deviation. So estimate of variation or noise. And you can see that there's this sort of big cloud. And the lower the gene expression level, the higher the noise. And these orange ones are all housekeeping genes. These red ones are the spikins. And there's an interesting reason why they're on the edge of the distribution that we eventually sorted out. And this is sort of, you know, what most genes do. They're somewhere in this. But there's a handful of genes that sit out here that have sort of excessive noise for their gene expression level. They're particularly noisy. And it turns out the reason for that is that they are differentially expressed in different subpopulations. And if you focus in on those genes, you can see that, you know, it's kind of really on-off behavior. And so this is now, every row is a different single cell. Each column is a gene. You can see that you have very discrete expression patterns for some of these genes, okay, on some and not in others. And so there's clearly subpopulations here that really jump out at you. And we can give names to the subpopulations as well based on the genes that are being expressed there. So this is FOXJ1, which was one of the defining genes for the ciliated population. And you can see it's only expressed and this set of cells, and not in any others. And so we call this group here of cells the ciliated cells. Likewise, SCGB1A, which is only expressed in the Clara cells, is basically expressed here. Looks like it's almost also sneaking into some of the ciliated ones. But this group we'll call the Clara cells. Likewise, AT1 and AT2, based on some of the key genes there. And so if you look carefully here, you can see there's 1, 2, 3, 4, and now a fifth population pops out. Okay, remember we said there were 4 known ones. Turns out when we look at the data here, there's a fifth grouping that kind of jumps out at you. And this one seems to be expressing genes both from AT1 and both alveolar cell types. And it turns out that this is a bipotent progenitor for both those, we believe. But I'll just, before getting into that, say that we now have lots of genes that appear to be uniquely expressed in the different cell populations, whereas before there's a handful, there's an order of magnitude more, and you know, many man and woman years worth of PhD projects for Mark's students to do. Now those that fifth population, you know, we went back and validated it by several ways, including qPCR, and here's sort of an interesting way to look at it. So this is now qPCR data. We've done principal component analysis on it, look at the loading, and you can see that you know, the AT1 and AT2 populations are pointing in different directions. They're kind of clearly, the genes that define them are clearly resolved here. If you do the same experiment on a day 16 embryo 2 days earlier, they're not resolved, right? They're all mixed together. And that's that population that's expressing both types of genes. This is an interesting progenitor cell. When it's trying to decide what it wants to be when it grows up, it doesn't choose one set and not express the other. When it's sort of undecided, it's expressing both sets of mutually exclusive differentiation genes, then it turns one set off, which is kind of cool. All right, so we'll pause here on transcriptomes. Any questions about that? No? All right. So we also, many years ago, began thinking about using the plumbing to do single cell genome sequencing. And you know, one of the original inspirations was to look at microbial diversity, where you know, only 1% of the microbial universe can be grown in culture, yet it represents a huge fraction of evolutionary diversity of life on Earth. And wouldn't it be nice if we could go beyond 60 nest surveys and really do genomes of these things out there? And so when Jan Marcy joined the group, he designed a chip to do just that, where we could isolate single bacterial cells and amplify their genomes, and recover the amplified material from the chip, sequence it. And we, you know, over the years, have developed more refined versions of the chip now with 48 chambers, optical tweezers to drag the cells around, and with a variety of collaborators have sequenced a bunch of genomes that haven't been from organisms that haven't been culturable and that either help fill out the tree of life a little bit or have been interesting ones for their ecological roles. And this has all been published. I'm not going to dwell on any further, but to say it was kind of a prelude for us to jump into single cell genome analysis of human cells. And I want to talk for a few minutes again, this is the physics crowd here, about how good you can do. You know, how well can you amplify a genome starting from a single starting molecule. Let's talk about some of the technical details. And when we started doing this, we used this amplifier called MDA, multiple displacement amplification, that was developed by Roger Laskin. It's kind of a beautiful thing. It's an isothermal amplifier. You have random primers. I just throw it all in and, you know, single temperature, it'll amplify whatever DNA is in your test tube with enormous gain. It's exponential in how it works. And we had, you know, a lot of success with it. And as this field started to pick up steam, people began to develop other kinds of amplifiers. You know, this group called Rubicon in Michigan developed an amplifier that became marketed by New England Biolabs, which was sort of a PCR-based scheme. And it had certain properties that seemed favorable, and people began to discuss them and publish on them. And then Sonny Shi's group started they published a very similar thing. It's a very minor variant on the Rubicon called Malbec. And all of a sudden, there was sort of a diversity of amplifiers out there, and it was unclear what were the properties. Any question? Hold that thought. Yeah, I got a few slides and walk you through it. Because we basically sat down and we decided, there had been a lot of chest beating going on at conferences and whatnot, and we don't care what amplifier we use, we just want to use the best one. So we decided we'll kind of bake them off against each other. And so several folks in the group got together and did a bunch of E. coli experiments with the different amplification chemistries, both in single cells and in bulk. And I'll walk you through what it looks like. So there's different parameters one cares about. One is sort of the specificity. If you're trying to amplify from a single E. coli cell, how much of what you get out is actually E. coli DNA, and how much is something else? And so in this graph, that's sort of what you're measuring. And green and blue are good. That basically means E. coli. Red and orange means not. And for you know, unamplified bulk DNA or bulk, you know, bulk DNA amplified in the tube, it's basically all E. coli. Same thing for Malbec, it's all E. coli. Now when you go to the single cell experiments, it can be quite different. You know, when you're doing these single cell experiments in the tubes with large volumes, whether with Rubicon or Malbec, it's just mostly not E. coli. It's mostly contaminant DNA. And you know, even with the MDA, there's a lot of contaminant in there. When you shrink the volumes, and we did small volume MDA amplifications, it's almost all E. coli. And so one of the advantages of these small volumes is you reduce the contaminant load by three orders of magnitude, right? If there's contaminants in the reagents or in other parts of the experiment, the The smaller the volume, the less contaminant there'll be, and it's very clearly reflected in these measurements. And you can see that when you start to identify the contaminants. So this is now the same graph, but where we've used a color code for what the contaminants are. And these large volumes is mostly human DNA. And you have to work really hard not to have that there, unless you're using these small volumes, in which case it doesn't really matter. And so you want to be, people are very tricky on how they report their data. And often they report only the data that mapped, which means they threw out 99% of it because it was contaminant. It turned out, and this sort of illustrates that effect a little bit. So it turned out that, you know, in scratching our heads and thinking about why the small volumes matter, we realized that, you know, probably the biggest effect had to do with gain, how much amplification you had. So instead of plotting things as a function of volume, we plotted them as gain, and that allowed us to turn that knob in other ways as well. And so this is now a measurement of uniformity, okay? How much amplified is the total coverage from a 5x of mapping depth. So of the stuff that maps, you accumulate until you have 5x genome coverage, you ask how much of the genome is there. For MDA, you can see the higher the gain, the lower the uniformity. The more you crank it up, the worse it's performing. And this is like the microliter volume gain, and so you're making a pretty big sacrifice. And the nanoliter volume is right around there. And that's one of the reasons why small volume is good. Less contaminant, more uniform gain. Now, the PCR-based ones, the MALBAC and the Rubicon, you can see they have this nice property that their distortion is pretty much independent of gain. That's actually pretty good. And in large volumes, they're clearly doing better. The PCR ones are more uniform. And it turns out, however, that the crossover point is right here. So, you know, when you do the microfluidic amplifications, you're getting pretty much the same uniformity as the best experiments in MALBAC and PCR-based amplifiers. Now, let's flip over and combine the two effects I just talked about, specificity and uniformity. And you can do that by looking at the same statistic, total genome coverage, but this time now in terms of raw sequencing depth. So you go to 20x genome coverage raw depth, and we're not filtering out the stuff that didn't map, and you can ask, how well do you do? And it turns out it totally washes out any advantage you would have gotten from the PCR-based amplifiers. You're making the contaminants really screw things up as far as that uniformity goes. Two more things to talk about technically here. One is the error rate at the level of single nucleotide changes. We're able to measure that for these amplifiers. And it turns out that these error rates are basically all due to the fundamental properties of the polymerase. It's the known misincorporation rates of the polymerases used in the amplifiers. And it turns out that the ones used in these PCR-based ones are substantially worse than the Phi-29 used in MDA. And so, it's about an order of magnitude better performance, maybe a little more, using MDA rather than the PCR-based ones, simply because of the enzymes involved. And the final piece I want to talk about is now structural variation, copy number variance, and so forth. This is where people had claimed that the PCR-based ones were giving better results, and what we find is consistent with that. However, there are some folks running around saying you can't do it with MDA. Of course you can do it. You're just paying a sensitivity trade-off, and it's quantified right here. So this is kind of the minimal detectable copy number variant in base pairs as a function of the gain of the amplifier. So the smaller this is, the better the performance. And this is what you get from the PCR-based ones. This is what you get from the MDA. And so, for the high gains, you're definitely doing better with PCR. Low gains, it kind of washes out. Okay. And that is sort of where we are with the technical performance of the different amplifiers. For most of the things we're interested in, we were very lucky in that the first one we use ends up having the best performance, especially for these de novo genomes because of the contamination issues. So why do you want to do single cell genomics of humans? After all, you can do a personal genome for an individual. But it turns out not every cell in your body has the same genome, and that's been known for a long time. And it's the case for a number of different reasons. One is in your immune system. B cells and T cells, focus on B cells to make antibodies. Each B cell commits to making a unique antibody, and their commitment to doing that is so strong that they reprogram their genome to make that unique antibody, and there's no going back to anything else. It's like Cortez burning his boats when he got to the New World. Once they've done that cutting and splicing, they can't go back to being sort of naive. And so, you know, if you look at the IGH gene, you know, the antibody heavy chain gene in these personal genomes, there's a mess there because it's averaging together lots of different cells that have different genomes at that gene. Another example are gametes, sperm and egg cells. They're all different, not only because they're haploid after going through meiosis, but there's been a tremendous amount of genomic diversity created there through meiotic recombination. So there's a whole set of genomes there that all contribute to the diversity of your offspring. You don't pass through your chromosomes unchanged. You've mixed together your own maternal and paternal inheritance in unique ways. Finally, cancer, which you can think about as the end state of aging. So every time a cell divides, there's a few replication errors. That creates genetic diversity among all your cells, and most of them are completely innocuous. But every now and then, you'll be unfortunate in the genes that accumulate those mutations, and the cells may start dividing without restraint, creating a tumor. And the tumor itself is genomically heterogeneous. And so those are interesting cases to try to tease apart at the single cell level as well. So we began using Fluidigm's C1 system to look at genome amplifications from single cells. And again, this is work from a former postdoc in the lab named Chuck Gawad. We used a cell line and did a bunch of benchmarking where he loaded in many different single cells and did genotyping to look at the results of different loci in the genome. So each column is a different locus that was genotyped. And it turns out that when you're trying to do human genome analysis at single cells, by far the dominant error contributor is allele dropout. Okay, so sites that are heterozygous in the cell appear to be falsely homozygous because one of the alleles is amplified over the other, and you lose track of heterozygous. And that's the largest contributor for a diploid measurement. So you can estimate that here. And you know, the bottom here are the bulk DNA measurements, and anywhere that the bulk DNA is heterozygous, you can look up and see how many of the single cells appear to be falsely homozygous. And it's some number, right? And you can collect all those statistics and look at them. This is one way to do that. So this is the allele dropout rate, and what fraction of cells have a good allele dropout rate. Something like half the cells have an allele dropout rate of less than 10%. Another third of the cells have an allele dropout rate between 10 and 20%, and the remainder have higher than 30% allele dropout rate. When you net it all out, on average, our allele dropout rates across all the cells we use in the measurements, it's in the low 20% range. And you may ask, is that a useful number or not? What does it mean? What does the allele dropout rate have to be useful in such measurements? And I'm going to argue that for the questions we're interested in, which is to try to measure the clonal structure of a tumor, clonal diversity, you can tolerate a allele dropout rate that high and still make sort of very precise statements about what the different clones are if you measure enough loci in each single cell. You can tolerate pretty large dropout rate by looking at large numbers of loci in each cell. And I'll explain precisely what I mean by that as we go on. Yeah. You know, fluctuations in the amplification, the lysis process, I mean, it's just a distribution. Okay? That's the way to break it down. Well, it's never always the same. So Chuck is actually a pediatric oncologist, and he works on this cancer called ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is the most common pediatric cancer. And you know, they're pretty good at treating these kids, and they can cure 80% of them. But in the other 20%, there's a relapse, and then they don't do nearly as well. And this is a cancer that's known to be polyclonal. Okay, and people have done measurements, sort of crude measurements of what the dominant clone is in a tumor, looking at things like copy number versus structural variation. And there have been studies where they look at diagnosis and at relapse. And what ends up appears to be the case is that only 8% of the time is it the same dominant clone at relapse as it was at diagnosis. Maybe a third of the time it's some clear evolution from the diagnostic clone. You can see the relationship. But fully half the time it's evolved from some much more distant ancestor that was present at diagnosis but wasn't the dominant one, and who knew it was. A small fraction of the time it appears to be completely distinct. And so we thought it would be very useful to be able to measure the entire clonal structure at diagnosis, maybe potentially to help people think about how to treat all the clones at the same time in the future, but also just to understand the evolutionary history of the tumor. And so experiments we did were to do, for each tumor, to do exome sequencing of tumor and normal to find variants in coding genes and variants that look like they might be causal in some way. They were validated by resequencing. And then the same tumors were used to do single cell genome amplifications in the chip. Those lysates were all recovered. And then we did the same panels on each of those single cells and used them to reconstruct the clonal architecture. So we're not sequencing the whole genome of each cell, we're amplifying the whole genome of each cell, but we're interrogating anywhere from a few dozen to 100 SNPs that we know are going to be interesting. We have a high confidence guess that they're going to be interesting based on looking at the overall sequencing. And again, there is a literature of people who have tried to look at the genetic diversity within a tumor by looking at allele frequencies and looking at non-trivial allele frequencies and trying to reconstruct the clonal architecture from that. And it turns out that is just doomed to failure. It's never going to work, and you can see that from some of the data I'm going to show you. And so this is now a histogram of what you get from the bulk sequencing of allele frequencies. And if you had a pure sample from a diploid, you'd expect to see allele frequencies of only 50% or zero, minor allele frequencies. But here you can see there's some non-trivial frequencies. That's because there's some clonal structure to the tumor, right? So that's a sign that there's something interesting going on. But this is now a violin plot. So it's a histogram turned on its side and reflected. So you can see there's a peak here and a long tail and another peak here. And so there's something interesting going on, but it's hard to know more without doing the single cell measurements. And when you do the single cell measurements, now here each row is a different single cell, each column is a different gene, and red means mutant, white means wild type. You can see that there's very clearly two different clones there. And in fact, they're there at roughly the same frequency. Okay, so if you tried to estimate from here, there was, from the bulk frequencies, there was a single clone. You don't know how many clones there are until you see how things segregate. And that's why these bulk methods are never going to work, because it's not uncommon to see different clones at comparable frequencies. And again, you can see, this is the effect of that dropout rate that I mentioned earlier. And if you have enough genes, you can imagine that you're able to cluster things, cells properly into one clone or the other. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes, how we did that. And so in this case, it's a pretty simple result. There seem to be two clones, and they're derived from some ancestor there. And these are the genes that are shared in the common ancestor, these two, because they're in both clones. Here's another.
Are there dropouts there, or is that something you're going to talk about?
Say again?
There's certain places where it looks like
they're correlated. All right, so maybe we'll talk about that for a minute now. That's your nightmare scenario here, is that the clustering you're doing is only finding things that coincidentally had the same gene drop out, and is creating artificial structures around that, okay? And so, you could say, you're very skeptical that, these aren't really two different clones, these are just group together cells where, you know, these genes happen to drop out and those dropped out, and, you know, it would be consistent with random statistics to see this occasionally. And so we went through and thought very carefully about that.
Well, the parallel guys within a box.
Where do you want to go?
So that big line of white towards the bottom of the top left.
This one. Here, yeah. This is probably miscluster, right? You might think that one might be, because you're having the mutations of the other clone. Maybe it's in that cell, maybe it's in the wrong cluster.
But it could also be a real pedigree thing, right?
It could be different, yeah. Yeah. You know, I'd have a hard time putting, I think you have a hard time putting a confidence value on that, that that was the case. And, you know, to sort of get to the chase, we developed, you know, pretty good models to assign confidence values for each clone and each cell being a member of a clone. We convinced ourselves it wasn't just random noise coming out of the clustering. Okay. Patient two, this is with the bulk, you know, allele frequencies look kind of similar to the other one, maybe shifted down a little bit. Here the clonal structure a little more complicated. There's three evident clones, and, you know, two that are more closely related to each other. This one picked up this set of mutations later. These are the shared ancestral ones for all three. The third clone's got this set, which is distinct from the other ones. And when you draw the history, it looks a pedigree. It looks something like this. There's two related ones. They share a more recent combination. This one shares the same later one. Yeah. And we did this for half a dozen individuals. This is Chuck. This is Winston Coe, who also was involved with the experiment, student in the group. And these are the first two I showed you. These are several other ones. Yeah, I mentioned that we did a lot of sort of thought and calculation about putting p-values on these. We also did some analysis that didn't require any clustering. We did multiple correspondence analysis, which is kind of the doing principal component analysis in the case of discrete variables. And I'm sorry it's not coming out here very well with the color and the pixel sizes, but basically, each of these different clones ended up, the cells ended up clustering together in this analysis as well. So with a non-clustering sort of approach, you're seeing the same groupings of cells come out. It's consistent. So more evidence that's not an artifact of clustering. And when you look at the actual pedigrees of each of these and look at the genes that are involved, many interesting things pop out of that relating to the biology of the tumors. I'll point out one here. For this person, KRAS is a late mutation. People usually think about that in a solid tumors as a driver mutation. Here it came in late, and, you know, why is there another clone that's not being outcompeted yet? You know, there must be some other mutation here that's in a related pathway that's compensatory and giving this fitness in order to keep up. This one also, KRAS, late mutation. Okay, so, you know, this we think is sort of the beginning of being able to apply these ideas of evolutionary biology to cancer, which has been done, you know, for many years in sort of a qualitative way, in a very quantitative way, by measuring the actual pedigrees of the tumors and the histories and being able to ask very precise questions about when mutations occurred and what's providing fitness. I might pause here. I've been talking for an hour. You want to keep going? I have another example we can do, or we can stop and discuss. I'm going to keep going? All right.
What about using RNA for the single cell stuff instead of DNA? I mean, I know you don't get everything, but you have more templates.
Yeah. So, you know, you worry a little bit more about the allele bias there because of, you know, allele-specific expression, things like that. It's something that, in principle, ought to work, and it's been underexplored up till now that way. I'm sure someone will get to it. Okay, so let's talk about gametes, which was one of the other examples. This is the work of Jim Benoit and Christina Fan, who were students in the group at the time. And we got interested in trying to ask this question of what's the recombination potential for a given individual. And it may have applications thinking about reproductive disorders, but really I think, you know, we're more driven by the basic science questions of, you know, what sort of meiotic recombination diversity exists in an individual. And there have been a number of projects and investigators who have looked at these questions across the human population, so it's sort of known population-wide what recombination statistics look like. And you know, we are interested in asking, what does it look like within one individual person? And so we looked at close to 100 single sperm cells from one individual whose genome had been sequenced. That gave a couple thousand recombination events, which is a pretty good set in this game. And we decided to call this the ejaculome. And the experiment is pretty straightforward. You know, sample collection is traditional, nothing small or microfluidic involved in that. Once the sperm has been obtained, it's loaded. In this case, this was done a few years ago. We were still using our homemade chips, which allowed us to partition the cells into different chambers, amplify the genomes, and then analyze them by both genotyping and sequencing. The donor had, we'd sequenced his genome, and we had done more than that. We'd haplotyped it as well. It turns out, there's another long digression we can make on this, but most human genomes that have been sequenced are approximations for a variety of reasons, but one substantial one is that they don't retain haplotype information. And so, you know, a true genome for each chromosome should have two long separate lists, the paternal and maternal inheritance. The way they tend to do is they merge them together, and they don't report haplotype phase information between the polymorphisms. And so that's an approximation. We worked out a single cell method of doing that and getting full haplotype information in human genomes a few years ago, and we applied that here to this person's genome, so we have full haplotype information. So for each single sperm cell, then, we could genotype them and for each, and then map them back to the reference genome and ask, did they fall on the maternal chromosome or the paternal chromosome? And by looking at where they switched from one to another, we could infer that there had been a recombination event right at that sign, so that this particular sperm cell had this new unique chromosome that had been created by meiotic recombination by combining this piece of the maternal with this piece of the paternal. Yeah? Make sense? Questions? The chips themselves, the plumbing, I don't know if it's so important right now, but I won't dwell on the plumbing, except to say, you know, very broadly, we flowed the cells down this long channel here, partitioned it by closing these valves, and then shunted the cells through these processing chambers, which allowed us to lyse, neutralize, amplify, and then recover the genomes out of those holes. And you can ask, how well do you do, again, on the genome amplification? Now remember here, these are haploid cells, all right, half the genome, so there's not a problem with allele dropout or things like that. Now it's just a question of how much of it is there. heterozygous allele dropout, I should say. And so we did the same kind of genotyping measurements. So each row is a different single cell. Each column is a genotyping measurement. This bottom row here is the genotyping measurement done on the bulk DNA from the individual, and it's color-coded so that red and green are homozygous for A or B, and blue is the heterozygous case. And so this individual had several loci which are heterozygous, and if we were really doing single-cell measurements, you wouldn't expect to see anything blue up here. Everything should be apparently homozygous because you know one allele with the other. You can see there's one blue that was probably some contamination or some extraneous piece of DNA. Rule that cell out. But the white ones are places where there was no measurement, and so some kind of dropout, that DNA wasn't amplified. And so if you ask for each cell what fraction of the genome was amplified, you can get a pretty good estimate, and that's what's summarized right here. Okay? And so, you know, on average, we're amplifying 75 to 80% of the genome, starting from single haploid molecules. Not bad. This is as measured by TACMAN qPCR-based genotyping. And we took the same lysates and put them on the Illumina SNP array and measured large numbers of SNPs, something like a million per cell. You can see that the call rates go down. You know, it's average more around 30%. But since there's so many loci, you're getting hundreds of thousands of sites genotyped per cell, which is a pretty high density for these purposes. Okay. And from that data, we can make these high resolution recombination maps for every single cell. So for each cell, we get a picture like this. These are the chromosomes. And for each one, we have a paternal and a maternal contribution, potentially. And you can see that for this cell and this chromosome, there's a big piece of paternal chromosome 1 and a little piece of maternal chromosome 1 that were fused together. This one is more complicated. Two recombination events. This one had none. You know, on average, it all works out the way one would expect based on the literature of one per chromosome. We do. You know, there's evidence for it. I wouldn't say we've conclusively proved it. And we made the argument in the paper. And it's been a little elusive, though, to really finish that one off completely, to be perfectly honest. So we're able to look at recombination probabilities at low resolution for all the chromosomes. So these are cumulative distributions. So the slope is proportional to recombination probability. The lines here are the data from the population-wide measurements done by HapMap and DECODE, respectively. The circles are our data points. And you can see that, sort of remarkably, they're in decent agreement with each other. And when you start computing statistics, our single-person measurements are in as good agreement with the population ones as the two population ones are with each other. And so, I like to say this is an ergodic principle of recombination, which is to say it doesn't matter if you measure it population-wide or on one individual, you're seeing pretty much the same behavior at low resolution and without getting into details of PRDM9 mutants and all that kind of thing. Put that aside. We genotype this person normal PRDM9 alleles. Yeah.
Why Illumina or versus say longer read technologies and where maybe you see that all going?
Yeah. So not true that we use Illumina all the way through. So all this TACBAN-based PCR genotyping is done, TACBAN PCR, we're using fluidigm chips to read them out, but it's ABI chemistry. And so for the low resolution stuff where it's two sites per chromosome, that's all done by PCR. And although we did sequence into several of the cells, and I'll get to the sequencing in a second, everything I've discussed so far has been done with SNP arrays. Okay, so it's not sequencing, it's measuring a million loci in parallel in the genome for doing genotyping. And you can ask, why did we use Illumina SNP arrays and not Affymetrix's SNP arrays? Because they both offer, we tried them both, and the Illumina ones worked a lot better with these single cell lysates. I think they're just, the chemistry there is less sensitive to the variation input material you get from these single cell amplicons. The Affy ones, you need more uniform representation for them to work. And so we just sort of empirically had better results with the Illumina SNP arrays and stuck with them. And it's related to the details of the amplification chemistry in the chips.
Short versus long read, I'm thinking long read like PacBio or...
Yeah, well there's no reads here, no sequencing yet. It's all genotyping.
That's what I'm saying, more of a step back.
All right, and now when you sequence, all right, you're anticipating the next... Give me 1 second and we'll come back to that. This sort of recombination is all done at low resolution. And you're stepping back here as well, looking at things at low resolution. It has been known for a long time that recombination is not uniform as you get into the fine-grained details, okay? And there's various hotspots for recombination that have been cataloged in various ways. And we sort of see the same thing as we delved into the finer-grained detail of the data. We found non-uniformities. Several of them were known hotspots that were in the catalog, and there were a bunch that weren't in the catalog. I think it was something like about two-thirds of what we saw had been previously seen. Another third appeared to be novel. And we went, and for several of them, were able to measure them independently and show that they are new hotspots for this individual. And so, thing about hotspots is, again, it had been known that they're not equally hot for all people. And so Norm Arnheim had done a lot of beautiful work doing PCR-based analysis of small numbers of hotspots on single sperm cells and known that different individuals would use them differentially. And this was kind of the first way to do it at a genome-wide level. And so we were able to sort of see something consistent with what he saw and discover many new hotspots that way. Okay. Then we went and we sequenced into several of the lysates using Illumina because it's not, and we chose it over PacBio, which you know we have one of those sequencers as well. And we chose to use Illumina because it's more cost effective and it's not a long read problem. Okay, when you have a reference genome you're mapping back to the short reads and you're interested in things like SNPs and point mutations, the short reads are very effective. And in terms of what you get per dollar spent on experiment, it was already very extravagant to do this. Let's put it that way. It would have been prohibitive to try to do it with PacBio for probably not much return. Even though you got longer reads, you got a higher error rate. And you know, why do you want long reads? Well, it's often for de novo assembly or for haplotype-based measurement. We had other ways of dealing with the haplotype issue. And so that's why. That makes sense?
It does, yeah. No, I guess I was also thinking just, you know, obviously somebody spends a lot of time thinking about sequencing, doing sequencing. Your thoughts on short read versus long read technology as it is today?
Yeah. You know, for de novo genome sequencing, you really want the long reads. And when we were doing the microbial work, it was all initially on 454 because it was a longer read than Illumina. And then Illumina improved, and we started doing mixtures of Illumina and PacBio. And you can see in the assemblies, it helps a little bit to include the long read PacBio stuff, but for the small microbial genomes, it wasn't, let's say, a very impressive improvement. So you could assemble just the short reads or short plus long, a little marginal. But for more complicated organisms with bigger genomes, these bacteria, they're all the microbes, they're, you know, a couple of megabase sized genomes. We got involved in a de novo project for this tunicate, Botrytis, that Irv Weissman has used as a model for stem cell biology for many years. And we tried to do initially with 454, and it was a mess. We couldn't get good assemblies because you really, for something that big, that's like a 700 megabase genome, you need to have much longer blocks to do it. And PacBio wasn't working that well at that point. We did run off a bunch of PacBio data. It wasn't good enough. We invented another way to do long reads that could sit on top of any sequencer, which we called Moleculo. And it's described in that paper for Botrytis. And the student who did it went off, started a company. It was acquired by Illumina. You can now get access to it through Illumina. And so if I was doing a de novo genome of any substantial size today, you know, I would look at either PacBio or Moleculo. You know, this Gene Myers has taken a big interest in PacBio and has built a new assembler around it that's sort of tuned to its capabilities and error rates called Dazzle. That's something we're wanting to take a look at. We're about to revisit the Botrytis and do another variant on that. And you know, in talking to my collaborator there, she seems to be leaning towards Moleculo. She thinks it's going to be cheaper overall to do it. There seems to be a cost advantage at the moment, but we're still burrowing down. I think technical performance, they'll be comparable.
Have you played with the Minion yet?
With which? Yeah, we got a Minion, and it was very disappointing. It was basically useless. So we put it away. What's that?
You're being recorded.
Yeah, that's the truth. Others have, you know, sort of stuck with it. And, you know, Eddie Rubin at the JGI has, you know, kind of stuck with it. And he says it's improved enough that it's being useful. So I think he probably sees it as ultimately something to replace or complement PacBio for long reads. And so I've been wondering if we shouldn't revisit and come back again. Be making some improvements. But it was, we were kind of turned off with the initial result.
Mm-hmm. Not just use Illumina sequencing. Would have cost us a small fortune to sequence 96 sperm with PacBio.
Mm. Yeah, it's still a niche thing with PacBio because of the expense. Okay, so anyways, we sequenced into a handful of these cells pretty deeply and mapped them back and looked for discordances in the mapping where, you know, you were seeing things that disagreed with both the paternal and maternal inheritance. And after a lot of thought and, you know, sort of trying to understand the error rates, we convinced ourselves that these weren't amplification errors, but were actually de novo mutations. And we were able to estimate a de novo mutation rate from these individual cells. And these are what they are in units of 3 times and 10 to the minus 8. And, you know, there wasn't much out there in the literature at that point. There had been a family pedigree that had been done. They saw a bit of a lower number. There were other arguments that the number should be higher, especially as a function of the age of the subject. And we had a lot of back and forth with the referees and the editors and decided this was our best estimate and kind of went with it. And lo and behold, like just a couple months after our paper came out, the DECODE group published another way to measure de novo mutation rates. What they had done was a much larger set of sequencing experiments where they had done family trios, sequenced the parents and the children, looked at novel mutations in the children. They convinced themselves that the dominant contributor to the de novo mutations was the sperm, the paternal inheritance, and they plotted it up, de novo mutations, as a function of age of the father at conception, and all the blue and the, all these are their data points. We had an N of 1. That was our rate right there, which we had done independently by these single cell measurements, and, you know, it lies right on the curve. It was amazing. I was so happy. I was so happy. So I'll stop here and sort of summarize. You know, that, you know, what I've hopefully led you through is that I think we have a pretty detailed understanding now of the various systematic and stochastic errors associated with doing single cell gene expression, both by qPCR and by RNA-seq. We've used it to dissect sort of cellular hierarchies in complex tissues. I just focused on the lung, but we've also done colon and tumors of the colon. I've talked about how we also look at genomes at the single cell level and have taken that from microbial genomes up to human for measuring haplotype, recombination maps, mutation rates. I didn't talk about that. But I talked about looking at clonal structure of tumors in pediatric ALL. But I'll stop here and happy to take any more questions. Yeah.
On your RNA-seq work, you mentioned that you did a FACS study before you. I wonder how much of a hit do you take on RNA destruction when you do FACS?
Yeah, how does the FACS affect the RNA levels? Yeah, it's, you know, it's a good question. It's one of those that, you know, always comes up. How much are you perturbing the tissue when you dissociate it, first of all, and then manipulate the cells? And, you know, the true answer is, you know, really it's kind of an unquantifiable amount of perturbation. And, you know, the best way to, I think, address it is by looking at how much function remains. And so this is, you know, where our biological collaborators are very strong believers in doing functional assays. When you do FACS on hematopoietic stem cells and you purify them and then you try to show that there's still the function to create a new immune system by implanting them in mice, you can argue that you haven't, you know, destroyed the essential biological essence that you care to look at. And I think that's the strongest argument, that, you know, there's many examples of functional preservation through this sort of handling. The undersampling. You mean the size selective sampling?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. So the way the C1 works, just for those who don't know, they're a little catcher's mitt in each little chamber, and the cells come in and get caught in that mitt. And when one is full, the other ones go around and fill up other chambers. And so there is a bit of a a dependence of the performance on the size of the cells you're looking at, and they in fact have three different size shifts, small, medium, and large, depending on what you want to look at. And if you have a reasonably pure population, you can pick the best one that works. If you have a heterogeneous population, you start to worry that you're enriching for one size and not the other when you do the experiments. You know, in the lung work, it happened that the medium chips were the right ones, and so we loaded the small and the large, and we can see that we weren't getting different types of cells captured there, and so we were able to verify there that we weren't biasing the experiment. You know, it's been a worry in some of the other work we've done, you know, you've got to kind of think about it in every case, I think. I'm sorry if that's unsatisfying, but that's sort of it. You know, it is an effect you have to think about and either calibrate for or take account of. Their new system, the Polaris, works differently. There are no catcher's mitts, so it's size independent. And so for things where we see a lot of heterogeneity, we're going to do it on their Polaris is the plan. Yeah. I'm sorry?
What's the coverage of your reads?
The coverage on the single cell experiments. Well, it depends how deeply you sequence. And that's kind of a cost decision as well. We know that intrinsically there's, you know, about 75-80% of the genome there to analyze. And we sequenced, I don't know, 50% coverage per cell or something like that. I forget the exact number. It's a bit of a decadent experiment, right? I mean, it's a very expensive experiment for finding a very small number of mutations. And I honestly think that, you know, the single-cell genome analysis is better served in cases where you're focusing on targeted parts of the genome, where you can use a bulk measurement to know where to focus in, as we kind of walk through with the cancer ones. And that's a much more effective sort of use of resources and sort of scientifically more interesting. So I think that's sort of where we are.
Well, I guess it'd still be very useful in pinpointing where the mutations occur, right? So when you find these mutations, are they unique to an individual sperm, which would mean they arose in the last, you know, the last meiotic division, or are they clustered?
Yeah, there's questions like that where, and again, maybe you can know where to look from some of the, if you find ones that were from earlier on, they'll be more broadly distributed. You might see them in some of the bulk sequencing. And you can use the same kind of approach there to be clever in your experimental design.
And have you expanded? I mean, you must have lots of data sitting there. You may not have looked at it this way, but this can also be used to get at the somatic mutation rate, because you're sequencing single somatic cells.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, we wanted to do that. Outside of sperm, you mean, for other cells. Yeah. Yeah, no, we've wanted to do that. And it's on the list, let's put it that way. But it's expensive. That's a very expensive experiment to do. We'll wait 10 more years, it'll be a cheap experiment to do.
Okay, great. Thanks.